Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Hannah Flint, whose new book, Strong Female Character, has just come out. It is partly a memoir, partly a manifesto. It's intimate and funny. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a real challenging, fascinating viewpoint and read. If you enjoyed the episode, please remember to subscribe, like, and do all those things. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
I was seeing Bardo, the Alejandro Inarritu.
Ah, right.
Which
It's
so interesting because obviously this is like kind of biographical for him as well. So it's kind of interesting as someone who's just done a bit of a memoir myself, like looking at like the way we tell the stories of our lives. So it's quite interesting for me to see how that manifests and like the idea of memory and stuff. So I'm sure we'll talk about that. But it was a bit long. Luckily, I didn't see the San Sebastian edit. I wouldn't have finished it until one. I've always been a big fan of like his visual storytelling and the way he does transitions, and it's just kind of beautiful in that way. Still need to let those feelings marinate a bit.
Yeah, he reminds me a little bit like of Highlander, the guy who directed Highlander, with his sort of like, you know, moving from one scene to another via a fish tank and coming out of a well, and the sort of pop.
I know, I like the seamlessness to it. I kind of like that kind of, you know, that you kind of that fluidity of the movement. And I suppose in a way it kind of serves the point of like the way memories and dreams, there's not a bit really beginning in the end. They just kind of float into. So yeah, kind of worked for me.
there's that line in Inception where Leonardo DiCaprio sort of turns around and says, Do you remember how you got here? And that's sort of like one of the ways you can tell it's a dream is because like, no, I'm just here, you know. Whereas your book, Segue. it's kind of about how you got here, as well as, you know, how you got to do what you do, as well as a memoir and all those things.
Yeah. So it's so funny because now it's done. I've had, and now I'm doing interviews about it. I'm kind of like, how did I do it? How did it kind of formulate? How did I come to this kind of? And so it's been interesting kind of trying to remember, like even the way I decided to kind of weave the memoir stories within the kind of film criticism. And I kind of when I think about it, it was far more intuitive than me kind of setting out. Like normally if I do an article or if I'm doing a feature writing or something, I might say, okay, I've got, you know, I'll have these sections. I want to hit these points. But this, it kind of felt, I started writing and then it was like, okay, now I want to go into this bit and then kind of going back and forth. So it wasn't really, maybe I shouldn't say, it wasn't well thought out. But I think that was the kind of beauty. And I think the beauty of, what I enjoyed about it was, you know, there's some things that immediately struck me when I think back on my life, memories and movie memories, because I think movies can often function a bit like music in that you connect movie to like music to a time in your life, to a memory, all those feelings. And I kind of had an idea of what subjects I wanted to cover, but then, and I suppose in my head, kind of understanding the stories that I wanted to tell. But then so there were certain things where I can remember, you know, I think one of the first, you know, I think my first like memory of being at cinema was seeing The Lion King at Waterman's. And, you know, I remember, you know, the stink, and I kind of put in like my first kind of thought of it is kind of being very super terrified when Mufasa gets the stampede thing. But then I also kind of thought, oh, what else struck you about that film and what struck you in a year since seeing it? And I was like, oh, actually, there's something quite funny about it showing, like implying a sex scene in a whole like song montage. I thought, oh, that's really fun. So, you know, certain memories, certain films and stuff where you think they might go actually kind of served in a whole different chapter, you know, and that was one about kind of losing your virginity and talking about that. And I thought that was quite a funny like way in. And so, yeah, there's certain memories that I have of watching films. And I suppose this is how I feel about cinema is like, I suppose I kind of say it a lot in the book is like, I feel like cinemas and movies are kind of a reflection of life. And I suppose I have a really, I feel a lot of empathy when I watch it, like, and so it's the emotional draw to them and that relating to what I see on screen and things like not having maybe the words to articulate how I feel about it, but how I feel about my life, but then seeing it's like, oh, that's what it was like. And then, yeah, I think it was kind of building from that one, the movie memories that, you know, immediately come into my head. But then also, I suppose, in understanding what I've learned from watching cinema over the last 30 years, and then how even going back to old stuff, like how my modern sensibilities of looking at it, like seeing it from this, you know, in the glow of 2022 has changed how I feel about it and how that might have made me feel then and how impressionable I might have been from the certain, you know, characters or storylines or tropes or devices, and or even just, you know, the type of actors we see on screen, you know, a lot. I talk about as being a mixed person of mixed heritage and only seeing a very specific, you know, white female standard for much, and a lot of the films in this have white female protagonists. So then there was another part of me where, you know, I wanted to, you know, as much as some of those films, you know, I was raised on, because that's just the way it is. I can't change the history of how I watch films. I can't go back and, you know, watch films that might have had far more kind of diversity in it. I just wasn't aware of. But it's like, how do I then put my like film critic and journalist hat on to say, well, these things were also there at the same time. And actually I'm so lucky that I've come to it later in life, and, you know, how, you know, even modern day where we are now, I wanted to make sure I include a lot of the stuff that we're seeing right now, because, you know, it's a memoir, but it's also, you know, it's looking back, but also what's the future and what's the present. And so, yeah, so there was a lot of, so there were some things where, you know, some essays took like, well, I call them essays. Originally I saw it as essays, but apparently, you know, people don't like the word essay. Apparently people roll their eyes at essays. Now we say chapters. but yeah, it was definitely kind of, I wanted to cover a lot of bases, but also letting myself off that I couldn't possibly cover them all. Like I can only go from my specific experience and my what I watched, you know, and obviously I can watch extra stuff. And sometimes it was great because, you know, it's just say I was doing a chapter on body hair. And I was thinking back to all the kind of, you know, shaving scenes I've seen in movies. But again, you know, the amount of movies you've seen obviously is going to slip in the gap. And I remember Helen Hart, when I posted on Twitter, I said, oh, can you think of shaving scenes? And she was like, One Fine Day. And I was like, oh my God, One Fine Day. I had that on VHS. I watched it so much. And I was thinking in my head, trying to wrap my brains, what was that film that I saw it in? And then by having someone just spark that memory, I was like, oh yes, that's what it was. And which I love that film, by the way. I mean, you know, kind of, you know, seeing Ticket to Paradise recently reminded me of how much I loved George Clooney in rom-com role.
That was one of his sort of false starts when he went to, you know, when he was coming off ER. He sort of did Action Hero with Nicole Kidman, and then he did rom-com, and none of them quite worked. And yet, you know, they were good movies, but they didn't quite match where he wanted
Peacemaker?
To be.
Was that the one?
That's the one.
Was that Peacemaker?
Yeah, with Neil.
It was a female director.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think it was, yeah. I remember that one, and she had a bob, and she's like the translator.
Yeah, and she sort of had, the poster was her running uncomfortably in high heel shoes, I think.
I mean, love that trope. I could have done a whole chapter on that trope.
Yeah, I think the Adjustment Bureau has, is it Emily Blunt running Emily uncomfortably Blunt. In high heel shoes?
I think there's also, I remember one of the other ones is Transformers, the one where Rosie Huntington-Whiteley switched roles with Megan Fox. And I remember thinking, she's tall enough. Why are you putting her in heels?
It's interesting the fact that, you know, essays, it sounds too academic. It sounds too much like homework. And that this book is the opposite of homework, I think. There's a real sense of fun and sort of, It gave me the feeling of sort of a film critic letting their hair down, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I really like that because I think that, and what I've learned as someone who's come into this field, and I hope I've articulated well in the book about feeling somewhat insecure in even having that kind of label because I haven't gone through the academia route into, you know, my love of film comes from loving film, going to it as a family habit, like that's what, you know, and even when I was, you know, started up and doing journalism, you know, that's, I wanted to talk about films, whether I was, you know, and for so long being able to call myself a critic, I felt like I wasn't allowed to do that for a very long time. And I suppose for me, I would just be pretending if I was trying to be, you know, if I was trying to be really be like a scholar on film, because I'm not, you know, there was probably, you know, there were some films in this where, you know, I think there's about 700, around 700 film and TV shows I reference. And, you know, there's, when I talk about some of the classic cinema, you know, the short, you know, the silent films, like these, some of these things I haven't been able to see, or I didn't study, or I haven't got the shorthand to be able to just like throw out some of those references. So for me, it was trying to be honest about where I am at, where what I can talk about, and not trying to be something I'm not. But also, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, one of the things I learned when I did my master's in journalism, and it was doing broadcast journalism, and I think one of the things stuck with me was when the tutor said, when you're writing for like TV, you're writing news, make it so like a smart 11-year-old can understand. And so I never wanted to feel I want people reading to feel, I don't know, excluded. I wanted to feel like they either watch the films, they can relate to them, or like, oh yeah, I've seen some of these films, or they'll be like, oh, I kind of want to watch that. I'll add that to my list. Or, you know, I don't want to ice people out. I want it to be accessible for everyone. And I think, you know, that's how I hope to be as a writer. And obviously, you know, that's just me. There are, you know, this is the beauty about, I suppose, where we are right now, is that you can find a writer for any one of your kind of sensibilities, or how you want to consume, you know, writing about film, writing about cinema, or writing about anything really. I think there is a voice for everyone. And I suppose, yeah, you know, at the start of my book, I kind of quote Charlie Kaufman, and that quote that I use is something that I printed off and stuck on the wall in front of me, so that anytime I was feeling that imposter syndrome, like, oh God, does anyone care what I have to say? You know, just seeing him where he's like, do you? You know, it might not think you're interesting, just take it off the table, but what you're doing, you're offering something like rare, something that's unique, and, you know, it's important. And I suppose that's kind of how I feel. I feel like at least whether it's just one person who kind of comes away thinking, I love it, you know, and then I've done my job.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think everybody has imposter syndrome to one degree or another. I mean, and I think you can tell the people who have them because they're the people who everybody hates. they're the people who definitely shouldn't be doing the job, you know, if you don't have some degree of humility, because everybody's got huge holes and gaps in their knowledge, especially now. I mean, when I was starting watching films in the 70s, it was kind of possible to watch a heck of a lot of movies, like a huge percentage of the movies that have ever been made. Whereas nowadays, there are just so many films coming out a year, and you've had another, you know, 50 years since then. So,
yeah,
you know, it's becoming
impossible. That's definitely, you have to let yourself off a bit. Yeah, it is. And also, for me, it was also trying to find, again, because, you know, I talk a lot about kind of insecurity I felt in my identity being half Tunisian, but even trying to find films that are Tunisian made, there's some things that you don't even, that aren't really talked about. You know, one of the things I kind of bristle at is doing the, you know, I kind of conscientiously object to doing like the 100 greatest films of all time lists and stuff like that, because I feel like all we're doing is some re-cementing basically the kind of the so-called canon a lot. And don't get me wrong, there are ways that we kind of add new stuff in, but it can feel like whenever you search for like films or something online, it's quite narrow-minded. So when I was trying to find stuff by Tunisian directors, I kind of one thing I was kind of lucky about was JSTOR was really great, because it not only has like classic kind of as like magazines like cineast, how do you say it? Cineast,
I think.
Cineast, yes.
Yeah, I think
so. You can edit that. You should have seen when I was doing the audiobook, the amount of time, you don't have to edit, but like when I was doing the audiobook, you write things down, you're like, oh wait, I don't know how to say this name or this word out loud. So there was lots of stopping and starting to try and get the correct pronunciation when I was recording the audiobook. But there was like loads of kind of articles that can look back at, you know, from the 70s and the 80s, these interviews that obviously were in print, you've not got like a link to now. So having that, but also having like, you know, it was a really great article about like sexuality in Arab cinema. And I managed to find some, you know, kind of context there as well to kind of put in the article, in the chapters, and then even getting to see that film now, it's like, oh great, I've got to see it. It's called The Wedding. See, this is the thing, it's like blocked in my head now I can't even remember the name of the movie, but there was a film set in Tunisia about two best friends, one's Jewish, one's Muslim, and I talk about this scene, there's a waxing scene in it. And it was perfect because I was like, oh God, this like gets, here we go, here we're showing, here I found this film that, you know, from writing this book, I was able to seek it out, and now I get to include it in this kind of conversation and then talk about how that is represented. And it was so amazing just seeing that scene when, again, waxing scenes and shaving scenes and films are quite slim. So, and obviously I've kind of got a Western, you know, I've got a Western understanding of the cinema far more than the international world, or what, you know, what manages to kind of, you know, trickle through the markets, whether it's festivals, the Academy Awards or things like that. So yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's been nice to be able to kind of fill in the gaps in my cinematic knowledge while writing this book as well, and hopefully kind of, you know, again, as much as I'm introducing myself to things, introduce other people to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always feel like a critic, like I'm, you know, I once got a job teaching where they gave me a subject I'd never done. They said, oh, you can teach geography starting on Monday. And it's like, I've never taught geography. I don't know anything. But, you know, this was a sort of private, very shoddy private school. And I found myself sort of Sunday night reading the 5 pages of the textbooks and then Monday morning walking in and teaching it as if I knew it as, I was an expert. And I feel like that as a writer on film. I'm often finding stuff and then writing about it as if I always knew about this. It's like, oh, they just discovered it, you know. It's so I mean, yeah. That's I don't think that's a problem.
Well, I think it's also, I think sometimes, oh, it's called The Wedding Song, by the way. It's just like Karen Albu. See, this is the thing, I'm like, if I'm going to name it, I want to make sure that I have the filmmakers. She's a French Algerian filmmaker, Karen. There is another thing that one of my editors said to me when, kind of after I'd submitted some stuff, I think when we were going through the first kind of edit notes, and they said to me, you know, you can have some more authority in what you're saying. Like, you should be able to, you know, you are in some way an expert on your subject, and don't look, this is, you're not writing for critics, you're writing for the general public. And that's one thing I had to really think about as well, because I think so often, I don't know if you found this as well, but sometimes when you put your work out there, and especially in the way we can kind of dissect everyone's work in a very public forum on social media and stuff, there was this, again, this kind of imposter syndrome coming in. It's like, oh God, are critics going to call me out or say I've got something wrong here? So there's that kind of fear, that peer pressure.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
of trying to, you know, then, you know, as my editor said, like, you know, the average person who's going to read this is not going to be, you know, they're going to welcome this as, you know, knowledge. So there's a kind of responsibility there to be honest and try and be, you know, as be informative in a way that's, you know, obviously correct. And a lot of film criticism is obviously subjective. So, you know, you kind of like cover your back a bit there. Mm. But yeah, there are some times when you kind of do worry if someone's going to say, well, that's not an observation, or you've got, you know, that date wrong, which I don't know. When going through this, I remember speaking to Nick DeSemlin when I'd finished it, and I was saying, did you get typos? Like, oh, everyone gets typos. And I think that's my worst fear, is someone's going to screen grab like the ebook and said, oh, you got this one wrong. It's like, I know they're there. I know the typos. I'm waiting for the second print.
Yeah, so yeah.
I have them fixed. My publishers will actually like, don't talk about typos. But I feel like, again, the anxiety in me is like, no, get ahead of the story.
Yeah.
I am aware. If you see a typo, I know.
Yeah, a document of 100,000 words is going to have a typo or two. It's just human nature. It's just you know, fallibility. Yeah.
And I think sometimes, again, it's that memory, because sometimes I'll, you know, even you'll remember a film and you're kind of like, have I remembered that correctly, or is it because I haven't seen it in 10 years that I get it right? So there's a lot of me going back like, did that happen? Let me just double check that definitely did happen. Or no, there was a thing where, you know, getting the quotes right as well, like slightly, and sometimes you might get like a word wrong. And I was like, oh God, yeah, I thought I got it right. I was like, no, quickly change it. Because you know, because there can be people, could be pedants who are like, well, actually, this is actually how it went. It's like, okay, thank you for that, Jim.
That's like a Mandela effect, though, isn't it? That, I mean, we have that in our culture where we think that films have lines in them that they don't have. But we, you know, I mean, what's the famous? There's a several.
It's the Luke Empire, like,
yeah, the one I was going to mention, the Empire Strikes Back. You know, he doesn't say "I am your father, Luke." Yeah. He says something else, and we remember it because that's the sort of the plot point, I guess.
Yeah, and I mention it, and I use that as a metaphor for my own relationship with my biological father, finding that out. So luckily I didn't quote that specific line. I would have definitely have to double check it. Although I did put no, and I was like, wait, is the no that Luke says, did I write it too emphatically? Like, does he really? And I was like, look, it's got like two, like three O's in it. I'm allowing it.
Yeah, that one can pass. I mean, yeah, talking about subjectivity, I mean, I think that's always an interesting sort of point of view, especially because, you know, what your book is bringing up and sort of emphasizing is that our subjectivities are very dependent on our lived experience and where we're coming from as men, women, as gender fluid, as in terms of our experience from where, you know, where we're from, our ethnicity and sexuality and all of those things. So it's not even like just, oh, things are just subjective, as in we all have different tastes. But I mean, one of the things I found was when I go to festivals, people I really admire love the shittest movies, and people I really don't admire get it absolutely right on occasion. So, you know, it's sort of nobody is infallible. Nobody has sort of 100. It's just so fascinating to talk to people who I think, oh God, you know a lot about movies, but you keep going on about how Chappie is the best movie you've ever seen. And you know who you are, by the way. If you're...
I think that's interesting because I'm sure, you know, I don't even call it a guilty pleasure. I love Marvel films. Maybe because it's this child, maybe it's nostalgia of it, someone who watched, you know, it's funny, I'm kind of, I'm rewatching X-Men, the animated series at the moment. The stuff that I watch on a, you know, Saturday morning, Spider-Man. My brother used to have the comic books and I used to kind of steal them. And I don't know, I don't know what it is about that genre, which I just really, it really, it's a comfort to me, really. And I know that there's, you know, I know that obviously there are some, you know, some of it's like trash and some of it also with the way it's just taken a stranglehold over, you know, what is released, what people spend it on, you know, and even, you know, are we going to get fatigue? And certainly in some ways I do have a bit of fatigue in some areas, but, you know, I think that doesn't mean just because I enjoy that doesn't mean that I can't enjoy, you know, like An Elephant Sitting Still, you know, in that 4-hour, very quite bleak films. You know, I think it's, we don't watch films in a vacuum, so there could be any number of things that have gone on in my life that has made it so that I enjoy this specific genre of movie. But I like the idea that now I'm like, I love far more variety of films than I ever did before, and I suppose I come from cinema as a place of, you know, I don't like writing bad reviews. I don't like going into a film and coming out disappointed. I want to have that escapism because I think it truly is an art form. And so it's one of those things where now, and every time is where I just don't get it, where I'm like, I love Malcolm and Marie, but a lot of people really hated it. And I just, yeah. Me and my friend, I've got a critic friend of mine, you know, I think a lot of people took issue with it because it seemed to be like criticizing critics. I'm like, but where's the lie? Like, I just don't see why we have an issue when a filmmaker using his art to deal with the subjects that they relate to. And I thought it was quite funny. I thought it was quite on the spot on certain things, but, or there'll be like other things like Spencer. I really did not get on with that movie at all, but, you know, people love it. But I just, just respect the fact that we saw different things. You know, I feel like, yeah, it's all about another thing that I feel about a lot is, and only after writing the book, and I kind of wish I mentioned it because I've just done a piece for Empire about Rashomon, but just like that subjectivity of truth and reality and like our perceptions. And I might be seeing the same movie as you, but I'm seeing a different movie. And I think that's an easy way to kind of, I don't know, let people off if they don't like the stuff that you do, or you don't, and we don't want uniform taste, otherwise that'd be just so boring and bland. And, you know,
absolutely. I mean, I find it easier to have people hate stuff that I love than it is to. I find myself really having to restrain myself from popping people's bubbles when they say they love something which is objectively, provably bad.
But then it's also, but then you see something like The Room, right, which is, you know,
objectively bad. But it's amazing. It's the best film I've ever seen.
Yeah. And that's like, and I suppose, I don't know, I think it's interesting because I think I touch on this a bit because I do that chapter on, I suppose, social media and the way we can so easily give our opinions. And I suppose, I'm trying to like think, like, what is the urge to kind of take that something away from them? I don't know. Like, you know, I think I get annoyed when I post something and someone replies and it's like a negative. It's like, oh, what's that urging you to say something completely bad about it? But then I suppose that is just human nature as well, because I suppose this, like, understand if we have such an adverse reaction to something, the idea that someone has a positive reaction to it is beyond. And also if we're kind of still sticklers, and don't get me wrong, there is a good form in criticism, like what should we be looking at in how we analyze film. But then also you have to take the, like, that emotional thing as well. It's like, I can watch, you know, like the film A Simple Twist of Fate, which I mentioned in the book. Like, the reviews for that at the time were terrible, But I can look back on that film really fondly because it was part of, you know, it was Steve Martin. I loved his films, especially the family stuff, especially stuff about fatherhood because of my own complicated relationship with my biological father and also with my stepdad. So, you know, I think there's the mind approach and then there's the heart approach. And I suppose it's kind of like accepting us doing, trying to do our best to, I don't know, write it out and then delete it. Save your tweet for drafts. But I totally get that. And I've tried to do better at not, because I think I have in the past been like, you know, oh, snarky, who cares? But then you realize like, God, there's humans behind all of these people. Like everyone's just humans and we can get, and I know how I felt when I've had criticism or like had people knock things that I've enjoyed. And it's like, do I want to give that back? So I'm not perfect, but like, I'm trying to do better at kind of just allowing that feeling or that urge to kind of, you know, go past, like fizzle out a bit and then just, you know, get on with our lives really.
I think, I mean,
another
I think,
movie.
They never stop coming. I think the for me, it's trying to use humor, I think, as a way of sort of soft, you know, I try to use sort of hyperbole and stuff like that as a way of sort of allowing people to like what they like and all the rest of it, but still be able to sort of get into the rough and tumble of critical, you know, shouting at each other and what have you. I think the worst one recently has been about Athena. Yeah. Have you seen Athena?
I haven't. I keep, you know, it was one of those things where I want to watch, but it's because I didn't hear anything about it, which is really annoying. Classic Netflix kind of situation where this film that everyone's talking about, but actually critics are talking about, but there's literally no promotion at all in the lead up to it, which it can be quite frustrating. So you don't hear about it, but I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard it's like Les Miserables, like kind of La Haine.
Yeah, it's a really good, I won't say too much about it because I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's got a lot of crash bang wallop and, but after the first sort of rush of people really praising it, it's a bit like La La Land or Gravity or something like that. After the first rush of people going, oh, this is amazing, people are going, yeah, but you haven't watched La Haine. I can see that you haven't watched enough French cinema for you to properly contextualize it. And it's just like, I fucking have. I absolutely have. Yeah. It's just that I like this as well. You know, somebody was saying, oh, it's all razzle dazzle. And it's like, yeah, but I like Razzle Dazzle. What's wrong with Razzle Dazzle?
But then, but also what I find frustrating about that argument, and especially when it comes to showing marginalized stories, is that, oh, we've already had this. How many white films about like white criminals or like, you know, working class kind of situations have we seen? We've literally, there is an endless number of these stories that are told from a white perspective. But when it's like a specific thing where you can tell this, a different story, it's like, I find it really frustrating because it just shows you're saying, oh, you're only allowed one at a time. Do you know what I mean? You only have one of those. Mm. And then you kind of just limit anyone from being able to tell that story again. And, you know, they're not the same films. Otherwise it would just be an adaptation. And I find that, you know, we're coming from a place where like Friends with Benefits and No Strings Attached came out like the same, pretty much like 3 months within each other, you know? And it's like, there are plenty of films that do the same stories, do it again, but it's like, how are we changing characters? Who's the leads in it? And yeah, directors, filmmakers and stuff like that. I find that kind of conversation. And I also think, yeah, there's a lot more pressure when you are talking about, when you're telling stories about marginalized communities, because it has to do so much at once, or it has to be like completely like brand new. Otherwise it's just, you know, derivative. And I was like, God, let me point you to this, to the canon, you know, like Joker, one of the, you know, biggest movies of the last however many, many years. And it's like Taxi Driver, king of comedy. Right. You know, I know it got criticized for that, but like, you know, it still did majorly well. And it's like, you know, people didn't mind that. A lot of people didn't mind the fact that we'd already seen basically this before, or seen this movie done, and it's not as good. I mean, I'm absolutely, you know, very publicly not a Joker fan. So I think there is this, I suppose there is a kind of the film Twitter, I suppose the kind of that community, and it's hard because obviously I feel like I'm a part of it, we're a part of it, but like against my will. I definitely feel like sometimes when, and the difficulty is that we could have a conversation like we are now, and we could watch a movie and have massively different opinions on it, but because we're having a conversation, we'd be able to have a very, you know, friendly, maybe get a bit heated, but you know, it'd be all, you know, we'd be fine with it. But when it comes to social media, articulating their thoughts, even when you're making a joke, someone, you know, you said you want to make a joke about it, some people would say that as like snark, you know, and it's like how people interpret it, it can be lawless out there. And so there's sometimes where I've kind of got in a situation where I've had, I kind of mentioned a bit, like where I've kind of feel like I'm giving very like inoffensive film takes, and it just be absolutely like piled on, like attacked, and you're like, oh god, like am I wrong, am I a bad person, like for sharing this thought? It's like, it's not that deep.
you know who liked One Fine Day? Do you know who liked One Fine Day? Hitler liked One Fine Day.
Oh, wait, you kind of cut out a little bit.
Yeah, it was.
I heard you say, you know who liked One Fine Day.
Okay, can you hear me now? There's a bit of a delay, I think.
Yeah. Do you want us to log out and log back in again? Maybe that might jumpstart it or something.
Let's try
that. I've got full bars on my Wi-Fi.
Yeah, me too. So I'll let's do that. Yeah? Let's do that. Cool.
Answer that way, it might be a lot easier to try, like, know when it's ended, when I finish what I'm saying.
Yeah, that sounds fine. And I kind of was already sort of trying to do that and not interrupting you too much, so that because every time I said something, it sort of seemed to happen about 6 or 7 seconds after I said it. So okay, I'll start with the last thing I was saying, which was, you know who liked One Fine Day, Hannah? Hitler. Hitler liked One Fine Day. That was my joke.
I honestly, it was worth the wait. But it is like that, isn't it? It's kind of like, there are things, and don't get me wrong, I mean, I can be like that a bit as well, because I suppose the things I care about, but I try and not do it to people directly. You know, because there's a whole chapter dedicated to how Arabs are represented on screen, the history of it. And so when Dune came out, it kind of was very frustrating to me that, you know, a lot of the reviews weren't really taking into account, you know, the like the kind of how much it's ripped off and excluded, you know, Middle Eastern, North African actors from this film, where it's obviously, you know, people always try and make excuses like it's sci-fi, it's this, it's that. It's like, people may say a lot of things just to stop Arabs having any sort of place in cinema that isn't terrorism. And, you know, I had people say to me when I did it, when I wrote a piece about it, someone did the classic, this is my favorite, someone said like, because I said, you know, Fremen's are obviously supposed to be like Bedouin Arabs, Imams, again, like kind of people who were indigenous to North Africa. I mean, it's called, or even the Middle East, it's called Arrakis, for God's sake. And someone's like, they are terrorists. I was like, you know what? That is such a simplistic view of who the Fremen are. And if you think that, because they say, you know, because it's the jihad that happens, right? And it's like, but if you think they're the villains, then you obviously don't understand what Dune is actually about. Everyone is villains. Mm. Everyone's a villain in Dune. That's the point of it. And then I remember when that kind of frustrates when you're kind of like, I can't be asked to get engaged with this, because it's like, oh, I talk about like a bad faith argument. Like, who has the time? Who has the bandwidth to process that? And then, you know, then when they were casting Dune 2 and, you know, the Padishah Emperor, which again, you know, that kind of name, the Padishah is like an Ottoman title for like a leader, you know, even like Persian history. And also, again, it's based on Ibn Khaldun's book, The Macadamia, and he talked about Arab civilization, and let's not pretend that like there weren't like, you know, Arab colonization, there weren't, you know what I mean? This is the whole point. Like, I think every kind of civilization has had some point of the kind of indigenous people, and then the people like in the metropolitan who kind of like empower, you know, that whole kind of dysfunction and that dynamic is prevalent in so many ways beyond Western colonization. And so when I was like, well, once again, we've got like literally all of that cast has been filled with white actors, Florence Pugh and, you know, Christopher Walken. And someone was like, well, why do you want them to play like colonizers? And it's like, okay, so make your mind up. You could either want us to not play the Fremen because they're terrorists, or you want us to not play the, like, you know, the emperor or any of that because they're colonizers. Like, just say you just don't give a shit about Arabs and let's just call it quits, because that's what basically is. And it can be sometimes quite frustrating when you know, there's a like kind of a lack of acknowledgement. And I suppose, you know, this is why I feel it was so important for me to cover this in my book, because, you know, there has been writing on it, as I mentioned, you know, Edward Said, Jack Shaheen, like there are plenty of like Middle Eastern, North African, I think we might say SWANA nowadays, Southwest Asia, North Africa, but there are plenty of people out there, but we just don't have like the voice, and we just don't have people care, because of the basic, I kind of think it's a lot about like geopolitics as well, you know, if you and how cinema has kind of like cemented this view that we are kind of other, you know, the thing about Athena, what's interesting is like, that's a great film. It's been said it's a great film, and it's like, oh God, it's getting in. It's like Lahan, it's like Les Miserables. And it's like, I kind of like, yeah, but I'm sure it will be, and I can't wait to see it. But I kind of, can we just have like, why does everything have to be wrapped up in trauma when it comes to like people of my heritage? You know, I want to laugh. I want to have fun. I want to, you know, I feel like, you know, we see when, you know, Sylvie's Love is a great example of like a black film where it's about romance, and there's not got this hangover of oppression that's fundamentally like, you know, do you know what I mean? That kind of, it's just nice to have like a love story between two black people where it's not, you know, wrought with, you know, undertones of slavery and all that when it comes to this black joy, right? So I'm like, I want Arab joy, and I want these films, but I just don't want them to be the only films. And I want to see mainstream, you know, I want to see mainstream movies and direct white directors who are basically borrowing from these cultures, or not even, are trying to ignore it or erase the origins where these stories come from. I feel like we do that a lot. And I think, you know, when it comes to, you know, Arab, Middle East, North African stories, you know, it's so funny how much we shoot in these regions, Jordan, Wadi Rum, like all those places. And yet we will not put people from those regions in the center of the narrative. You know, yeah. I just think it's funny with Star Wars. Like, I went to Mos Espa recently. I went to Tunisia recently.
I saw your pictures.
And I was like, why? How Tatooine? Yeah. Well, yeah, I had to do it with my little Obi-Wan Kenobi doll. It was so funny. Someone there was like, oh, can I take a picture? Like, because I brought it. She was, oh, can I take a picture of it? And I was a bit like, no, get your own Obi-Wan Kenobi. But I don't want to be a dick, so I like that. But I was like, you best not post it on social media. Don't steal my thunder on this. But I'm there, and I'm basically like, I'm like, how are there so many white people on Tatooine? Like, they would be sunburned because it's so hot. Do you know what I mean? When you're in the actual desert and like there's, you're baking, and you're like, white people would not survive here. Why are there so many white people in these desert locations? Like, it doesn't make sense. But, you know, again, as I said, you can have space Arabs as long as they're not Arabs. Yeah, but do you know what I mean? But like, show them that way. Show them like be like rednecks, but they don't. It's like, yeah, it's, you know, the emphasis on, you know, science fiction. There's a science fiction there for you, white people in deserts.
Well, I think that's fascinating as well, because science fiction is such an unlimited imagination when it comes to to many, many things, and then so limited when it comes to gender relations and race relations and race casting and all that stuff. I mean, I'm reading Ursula K. Le Guin at the moment, and it's just like, wow, she really knows how to use science fiction to really push the boundaries of our thinking. And it, what's depressing is she's doing it in the 1960s, and nobody else has, you know, Blade Runner 2049 is an example of really old, tired, cliche gender relations, and it's been made recently, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, it's, I mentioned, you know, I love Blade Runner, but I mentioned in the book, like, Ridley Scott as a filmmaker, oh God, I love him, and he's made some great films, but there is a lot of things where he's kind of just had blinkers on when it comes to certain representation, like, you know, I know it's not science fiction, but Gladiator, it was interesting reading about that and learning that actually they're, you know, which I mentioned in the book, that their actual historical consultant was very surprised that it featured Arab slavers in it picking up Maximus when they weren't even around in that area. It's like, let's just pick and choose what we want to put in to make stories, you know, and Blade Runner, you know, the history of that, you know, how, you know, talk about the ravishing in films and Sean Young. It's funny, I actually interviewed Sean Young for Empire magazine for a feature. Very interesting person. A lot of stuff didn't make the cut, probably couldn't, because it's, you know, it's interesting as I don't know, how would I say it? She'd obviously been through a lot in her career, and I kind of believe a lot of the stuff she said, but she had certain things that are quite problematic that I was like, ooh, we probably won't put that in this time. I'll tell you off the record, okay. Maybe what she said. But even that, her experience of like being, you know, somewhat brutalized in that scene between Decker, her name's escaped me now.
Rachel.
Rachel, yes. So that scene, it kind of like how in the moment she kind of felt that it seemed to be somewhat payback, like because she allegedly turned down his Scott's advances. And so we see that scene and you kind of look at it with that, when you look at it with that knowledge, you kind of like see it and you're like, oh, wow, that is a bit slightly messed up. But what does that teach us about how we understand about sexual relations between men and women in general, like what be conditioned to see? And I suppose again with sci-fi, you know, I as you said, like how we present it, why is it, who is it, is it Carl Sagan who said years ago, you know, talking about Star Wars, and he was like, well, why does everyone look like me? This is a galaxy far, far away. Why is everyone white? And, you know, even watching Andor recently, which it's amazing. It felt like the first time truly that we've, you know, I love The Mandalorian, but like this felt like, oh, I'm really interested in this story because it feels like untapped territory. And it feels like Tony Gilroy as a showrunner is really kind of really making Star Wars political again in a very obvious way rather than, you know, quite, you know, vague. Like I think a lot of people, you know, it's so funny that we've got to a point where people say, don't make Star Wars political. It's like, it's always been goddamn political. Like that is like the Viet Cong versus America. Like that's what it's supposed to be about. And obviously, you know, it's ripped off to Dune as well. But I babble about that enough. But like in Andor, what was interesting for me was, again, there's a main episode 3 was so beautifully executed. Yet there's only like 2 female characters in it. And even, I'm not talking just like speaking characters, but you notice even in the back.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
background, like, you know, the corporate soldiers or corporate police force, you know, all of them are men. You know, there's probably about 70-80% of the people you see or even have speaking lines are men. And you're just like, why are we still in this world? Why are we still in this? Why are we projecting our specific kind of society into a galaxy far away? Can't we like expand on that? Can't we do it differently? Can't we, you know, I loved in that series, in the episode, because we see in the indigenous planet where Andor is from, it's like a woman leading it, but it's such a small scene. And you're like, well, why can't this be everywhere? Why does it have to be still projecting our patriarchal society in another world when the possibilities are endless? So yeah, it can be quite frustrating where actually sci-fi is like, let's just put a spaceship and then just do, you know, 80s England.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hate to bang on about Le Guin, but, well, I don't. I love her as a writer and as a thinker. But, I mean, just she has a simple thing where marriages on one of the planets she's talking about are between four different people. And you just go, huh, there's an idea. And in some ways, that kind of makes more sense when you have people who have, you know, the nuclear family is no longer as sort of ubiquitous or as universal as it used to be. Or indeed, if it ever was, actually.
John, can you just repeat that again? Because it was really crackly.
Sure. Ursula Le Guin, she's talking about a planet in which the family unit, a marriage, essentially, is between four people. So it's two men, two women, and they have sex, you know, interchangeably, let's say. And it just shakes up. You think, well, okay. And it's normal. It's not like this is, whoa, look at this freak show. It, for that planet, that's normal. And the idea of having just a couple is a little bit odd, you know? So yeah. just stretching those possibilities where why would every planet have, you know, a 19th century idea of what a family should be?
Exactly. That's, and you know, a lot of people didn't like Thor Love and Thunder, but I did think it was quite good that like the kind of, at least that tried to, you know, shake up how, you know, with Korg, like, you know, it's a kind of shame in that movie that that's the only kind of, I suppose, LGBTQ representation like in it, even though Valkyrie's supposed to be a character that's, you know, you can definitely see the Disney censors all over that. I'm sure they did a scene where Valkyrie kisses a girl on the lips. But, you know, even having that bit, it's like, oh, yeah, look, it's science fiction. They can literally make up anything that they want. I'm trying to think. There was this book of short stories I read recently by Malka Older. And it was really amazing how she does, like, it's all science fiction. And there was a story in it where like there's people from England, from Earth. Mm. And like in that they meet, you know, extraterrestrial alien, you know, race and actually the women are the leaders. And in the way that, and it was so interesting how, and I feel like, God, I'm in this position of like, do I want to give spoilers away? But there's an element about like how she's trying to mask her emotions because she's been taught by male leaders that you need to just not give anything away. Mm. And then so she goes there, she's an expert on this so-called, you know, alien race, and then it turns out actually their whole leadership is about emotion. That's why women are leaders, because they're emotionally led. So it's such an interesting idea that like actually emotion in this like world, that's what's celebrated in this race. It's celebrated to wear your emotions and your trauma and your grief, you know, on your sleeve rather than holding it all in. I was like, oh, that's such an interesting way to look at sci-fi. I mean, you know, I kept reading that book, I'm like, God, I'd love to see any number of these like short stories adapted into a film.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's just about imaginative possibilities, and it's also like it's out there in the world. There are loads of places which have huge cultural differences. And, you know, that's sometimes why we go to see films. But just to change tack a little bit, one of the things that really impressed me about the book was the idea that you're using film as well to talk about things which are very intimate. We already talked about the shaving already, female hair and all those ideas. And you get into sex, you get into masturbation, and it's done really well and really interestingly. And that sort of struck me as such a bold place to go, because that's sort of something that I would certainly sort of hesitate or feel not weird necessarily, but just feel exposed by about writing. So I mean, kudos.
Oh, well, thank you. It's funny, when my mum read the book, because obviously I do a whole chapter on motherhood, and there's obviously a lot of personal information in there and feelings and emotions. And she, you know, it was funny when she came away from it, the thing that she was most concerned about was actually like, are you okay with having people know about your sex life? Mm. And I was like, oh, that's the thing I care least about. Because I think... I just, you know, don't get me wrong. It's interesting. There are things that I would say in this book that I wouldn't just tweet about, because I feel like, I don't know, I feel like this is specific for this book and I can do it. I don't, you know, I think sometimes 280 characters seems a bit, you can't really get into it. Whereas this, I actually had space to explore it and, you know, have my own voice in it where, you know, I'm not going to get it picked apart, like if I posted a tweet or something. But for me, it felt like I can't be this sex positive. I feel like sex positive voice and, you know, want to champion that and see more representation and hopefully like have, you know, again, like I hope that people reading this will find, hopefully feel more emboldened to embrace their own sex life as well. Because for many years I hadn't, I was, you know, as I say in the book, there's some things where I used to not center myself in romantic relationships, didn't know how to orgasm or, you know, all these different things that I think for too long, you know, sex has been treated as this taboo. And cinema has only really presented a very masculine view of sex. And so, yeah, for me, that was quite funny. But also, as you know, you mentioned earlier, like, you know, like humor, being able to talk about stuff with humor. And for me, that was the biggest thing about writing this, is that, and maybe I kind of say this a lot, but I'm kind of like Chandler Bing when it comes to uncomfortable subjects. I always try and make a joke out of it. Maybe it's like a defense mechanism. It's like, well, I'm taking piss out of myself, so you can't. So yeah, there's definitely an element of trying to make it a bit jokey. And I don't know, maybe that makes it a bit more accessible. Like, hey, it's weird and it's uncomfortable and it's awkward. And like, that's, you know, that's what I love seeing on screen. So I feel like if I wasn't as open, it wouldn't be as authentic to the story that I really wanted to tell. So yeah, that was talking about my sex life. I suppose there's things I definitely didn't put in. Like I kind of wanted to avoid too many, you know, specific anecdotes. I don't know. There's things that I just didn't want to just throw in for the sake of throwing it in. Because I think, you know, again, it's memoir, but it's not, you know, the anecdotes are there for a reason, and I could just have like thrown it in, you know, done a load of like, oh, this sex scene, this actor I banged or whatever like that. But it had to be kind of, I wanted to make it a bit more concise, so it had a point rather than just, you know, throwing things in for the sake of throwing things in. Who knows, you know, maybe the next book I'll get into more detail. But actually, for me, the hardest thing is writing about I suppose my family stuff. That was the hardest thing, because, you know, you want to be honest, but you also want to respect those certain things I didn't want to divulge on. You know, it's not just me I'm writing about, you know, I'm writing about other people in my life, and or obviously not in my life in the case of my biological father. So I wanted to be really mindful that I was being truthful to the situation, but not, you know, letting everything hang out. Because I don't want, because you just don't know if some, you know, again, my mum's a public figure. And so the idea that I don't want to write anything that could potentially be used like against her or anything, not I think it is, but I think, you know, the our relationships with our parents, you know, no matter who they are, you know, there is, they're not perfect. And I think, you know, for me, it was really important to contextualize like where my mom had come from as well, like what her upbringing was like and how that had an effect on how she might have raised me or like what she's going through, and trying to have that context as well. So, but yeah, I remember when I was writing it, no, I did actually have to, I was like, mom, you can get copy approval. And it was quite tense sometimes because there's a lot of things when I wrote it, when I wrote the original stuff, especially for her to look back at the time when we're talking about when, you know, when she was with my biological father in that period, it did kind of, there's a lot of memories she suppressed. So it was quite an emotional time for her to read this stuff. But ultimately she was, you know, she cried, she laughed. So, and she's proud of it anyway. But yeah, I don't know. It is interesting because I feel like, you know, the biggest inspiration for me writing this really was a combination of like Roxane Gay's Bad Feminist. And also I remember reading Caitlin Moran's How to Be a Woman years ago. And, you know, she was very open and honest and made a joke out of it. And I thought, you know, yeah, I could do that. And also my experience is very unique to me. So I suppose in a way I was kind of trying to write the book. And I don't, you know, but I don't think there has been, oh God, not to, maybe there has been a book like this, but I feel like how I've done it to do this memoir with the movie commentary and stuff like that, I don't think I've, well, I haven't read anything like that. So I was trying to write a book that I would have loved to have read when I was younger. You know what I mean? The book that would have like made me feel okay. Like I was really, I'm really writing it for my teenage self, to be honest, if anything. So it's trying to be like as relatable, authentic, but also knowing there's, you know, I don't have to put everything about everything. It's like, I don't have to have every single movie reference in it. I don't have to put every single part of myself in this book. I just, what's relevant to telling this story and hopefully kind of making the points that I wanted to make.
And it's so interesting because it's like, I think what it brought back to me, and obviously I'm from a really different sort of generation as much as anything else, but what it brought back to me is just how much you learn from the movies, how much you look to the movies to escape, yes, but almost how much you look to the movies to go, what is a relationship? What should I feel? What should I look like? What is cool? What is the definition of asshole according to Bruce Willis? You know, where do I get these? And so, and you're not sitting there thinking, oh, this is ideological and I'm going to get it. You're sitting there just thinking this is the way the world is. So of course it's the perfect moment for ideologies to sort of seep in without you, because you're so unguarded when you're watching films. So that's what I found with this book, was just appreciating how the impact of films and how they intertwine with even the most. I'll give you an example, actually, going to the more intimate side, that to speak euphemistically, I guess, being a little bit, but like I wanted to do a video essay with Lee Singer, who does all these wonderful video essays. And I proposed to him one about male masturbation, because whenever it's on screen, male masturbation is seen as being like either Fanafana American Pie or Kevin Spacey in American Beauty. What a sad wanker. Literally, what a sad wanker. So when I was reading your chapter about masturbation, I was sort of going, there's a bit here that I could say about blokes. But of course, that's because I'm a bloke watching men wanking and thinking, you know, and then you see Call Me By Your Name, and it's like, there you go. That's how you do it.
1 second, John. Just, I think my dad's just coming into the flat.
Okay.
Hi, sorry. You're a bit tired.
Sorry.
Yeah, don't worry. Sorry. I'm by the front door, so I can hear like scratching. no, but that's, I think you're totally right. Like I you know, I suppose when I'm looking at masturbation, I'm not really looking at I mean, I'm so used to seeing it, so I don't really notice nuance because I've never, you know, masturbated with a penis. So, my own penis. But I think that's the thing. And but what you do notice is when there's such, we get these stereotypes, and this is the problem, is that we create these tropes and then they become cliches and repeat them, and then they become the norm. And then suddenly, how do we move away from that? How do we show actually that's not really realistic? You know, there's a lot of things where Yeah, definitely. When it comes, it's interesting. Like, I can definitely say with male characters is that, you know, there's a certain type, of action here. This kind of stoic kind of, that's the way it's supposed to be. And there's a lot of emotion. You know what I mean? Like kind of not room for that. And I feel like nowadays we are having that far more. We're having more like, we're moving part these stock characters. And I think what I was trying to do in this is like how much these stock characters, again, like you said, like, well, as I tried to say as well, it's like, there is such an influence because when you're not having conversations at home, when, you know, sex education is so small and it's such a, again, still such a taboo thing that you look to what's on screen and, you know, looking at porn as well, it's important for me to kind of look at that subject because, you know, that has, that's technically, that's still their films, their movies, you know, it's still using the same techniques as they would, whether it's Boogie Nights or, you know, whatever's on new porn these days. But so it's kind of, how do we acknowledge that and then maybe kind of work against it and see how we can improve and try to break those cycles and again try and move from these kind of stiff boxes for but like if we can try and like broaden our understanding so that we can feel really and see and be what's honest because again you know obviously when it comes to fiction and even non-fiction what we see on screen, there is a story to be told. There is, you know, artistic license. But I think so often nowadays we're so influenced by what we see on screen that we see that as truth of the situation in so many ways it can be. But if we're kind of perpetuating fallacies, then, you know, how do we evolve and grow and progress? And, you know, and I feel like a lot of the time we're quite stunted and it takes... And this is why I think what's so good about criticism and having more voices in it, because, you know, if you've got still people are telling you the same thing, you're never going to know otherwise, you know, and I feel like that's why I think it's important to have these, to understand the art that we put out there, that actually we can discuss something, we can love something, but also understand where it maybe perpetuates bad things, even while it's a really entertaining kind of film, you know. I love American Pie, but come on, that whole scene with Nadia is kind of gross when you think about in the cold light of 2022. I would even say like earlier than that, I think a lot of people felt like, oh, this is a bit awkward. So yeah, it's not about like totally shitting on films that might have our taste wise or sensibilities have changed, because you know we can't go back and change time. I can't go back and stop Alec Guinness doing brown face to be in Lawrence of Arabia. But, you know, I think we can understand why we don't do that anymore. You know, there's a reason why we don't do these things. But there are a lot of things where it's, you know, we're in this gray area when it comes, because we've got so much more content and we've kind of moved on a bit. It's like there's such a gray area now. So it takes a bit more precision to understand how these kind of covert, kind of prejudices or kind of misrepresentations or depictions can actually penetrate the wider culture and wider society and kind of keep them from progressing, rather than thinking actually we should probably nip that in the bud.
Absolutely. I come from literature, so I find I don't have much of a problem with this sort of separating art from the artist sort of thing. I don't even feel the need to do that. I can appreciate stuff made by terrible people, you know. It's a conversation we need to have, and it's a conversation and it needs to be out there and expressed, but it's never sort of stopped me from watching stuff.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, bad people make great art. There are bad people in the world. And I think what we've seen in Hollywood, there are a lot of them there. You know, you don't have to be a good person to make great art, you know. But I think there's something about what I feel like now is, what do I choose? Do I need to watch it? Like, sure. You know, there's this thing like, do we need, when I think about all the films that I haven't seen, you know, I was thinking, there's a bit in it where I talk about in the chapter on kind of like Me Too and like the representation of like rape and sexual assault and rape culture in cinema, but also looking at the behind the scenes or something. And I remember, you know, Hitchcock, I can appreciate that he's a great filmmaker, but again, when you think about what went into that film, do I need to watch it? Do I want to watch some of this stuff that might be like, okay, maybe I'll watch it once. Do I need to keep watching it again? Or could I watch someone who maybe hasn't sexually assaulted his actresses or, you know, done psychological warfare against them as well? Like, do I need to watch that in my life? Are there a million things? And that's just my personal choice. I would never, you know, there are people now who, you know, one of the things I won't do is, you know, Roman Polanski, for me, I don't want to watch any of his films because he is a convicted rapist, pedophile, and he's never served his time for that conviction. He ran away, and whether you believe, you know, he was given too harsh a, you know, sentence, blah, 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 all that. He did it. And I feel like if he wasn't a filmmaker, if he wasn't a great artiste, everyone, if he was just, you know, a plumber, everyone would be like, no, you need to go to jail. Do you know what I mean? Like, he wouldn't get away with it. I feel like we need to also understand that just because someone makes great art doesn't mean that they are above being held to account for the pain they might have caused off screen. And, you know, the fact is, I can't stop him making, you know, movies now. No one can, because he's obviously still making it. But I can choose not to watch any of his films and not try and endorse it. And that's how I feel about certain filmmakers, because there are so many others out there. We are in literally the best time, really, when you think about it. We've got more choice than we've ever had in the history of cinema, more filmmakers, and filmmakers who might not have historically got the opportunities. I think about all the filmmakers who have, you know, there's a great documentary called Half the Picture, and it interviews a lot of female directors, and, like, you know, like Mary Harron or, you know, Mary Lambert, these, like, he did great films and they haven't had the same opportunity as their male counterparts. You know, and I think that makes me sad, you know, the fact that there's a lot of filmmakers out there who are terrible people, terrible, harmful people, but they've had every opportunity to make the movies that they want to do. Whereas people, other, you know, whether you're a woman or person of color, you know, any other kind of, you know, intersectional, from an intersectional background, they haven't had the opportunity. So I'd rather spend my time trying to learn about that and seeing film for what, you know, those stories, see those stories being told, than, you know, watch Polanski basically do a thinly veiled kind of defense through French history of an old story about someone being falsely accused of something. It's like, oh God, I don't need that in my life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a valid position, and I just find that I'm very, I don't know, I suppose this is a very personal sort of opinion. I don't see it as dictating what anybody else has to do, but I'm just one of those people who I have to see stuff. And you know, I remember very early on in the days of the internet, when Saddam Hussein's execution was online, and I thought, oh, I've got to see that. I mean, now I don't know why I have to see that, but I can remove the context of something from the thing itself.
And, well, that's what Nope is all about, right?
I've not seen it yet.
Oh, okay.
It's all about Saddam Hussein.
No, yeah, it is. It's actually, wow, that's the spoiler.
That's the twist.
That's the twist. It's kind of insane. No, but it's about the spectacle.
Right, I see.
Why we're so, you know, why anything that can be, we're kind of desperate to see, maybe also, there may be something also because it's like there's the taboo of it. Like, we're not supposed to see it.
Oh, know? Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I mean, I come from a Catholic background, so it's like, you know, tell me not to do something and that's immediately what I'm going to do.
You just go to confession a week and do seven Hail Marys and you're good.
Exactly. I miss it so much.
But I think that there is, you know, it's like sometimes I find, do you remember, you know, when there was like the hack of where all these women's, all these actresses, you know, against online.
Fappening.
Yeah, the fappening, right? Yes. And like everyone's searching and Googling it, and like we all did it. And it's like we've got this morbid curiosity as well. And I suppose there is that need. But I suppose for me, again, I think it, because I do find that I do have this emotional, like, I find it really difficult to watch anything Johnny Depp is in now. I remember seeing Murder on the Orient Express, and it was just after the whole stuff, because I remember being in a newsroom when all the stuff was going down with the divorce, and you could see it from very early on how much his team had kind of, you know, you can see the PR spin, you can see the crisis management work, and you can see where it was coming from. You know, I don't, you know, I don't know you or your listeners, but I'm very much firm. I'm sure I wouldn't like Amber Heard as a person, but I 100%, you know, side with the what her accusations, especially as in a UK court, it was proof, like he proved it. Anyway, beside that, but I remember seeing Murder on the Orient Express and just thinking, oh God, he just leaves a bad taste in my mouth now, and I enjoy it less. So it's kind of like, I want to avoid things where I watch Fantastic, I'm going to go in and just not enjoy it. Like Mel Gibson, like, I don't want to see a movie with Mel Gibson in. Like when I saw Daddy's Home 2, I was like, oh, this guy. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and that's just me personally. Obviously, everyone has their own relationship to those things. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I'd never kind of like, I might eye roll a bit, but I would never like call someone out for doing that. But I do think there is something to be said about like, what we cover as media, what we choose to cover as media outlets. Because when I think about like, when it comes to reviews from festivals, it's always interesting to me. It's like, what was it recently? The Louis C.K. like, I think it's like, oh, they'll review a Louis C.K. film, but they won't review any number of these films with unproblematic people. But like Variety will do a Louis C.K. review. And they, you know, they've only got a certain amount. They can obviously nowadays, there's only a certain amount of films they can review, but they'll do that one because they'll get more clicks for it. You know what I mean? That's the culture. They want to get more views and therefore more ad sales, blah, blah, blah. That's why they're doing it. And it kind of makes me that makes me sad because actually I feel that's less about, I want to see the art. It's more about, oh, well, what will I get from doing this? There's a kind of, I suppose, like a, it feels less authentically, less pure, I suppose, about wanting to cover it. Whether you say, I just want to watch everything. No, I want to review the films. That's why, you know, it's so interesting nowadays about when you see, you know, film festivals where they're having a lot of films from streaming services or stuff that's already got a theatrical release and they're getting covered when they'll already get covered by the time you know, the distributor comes out. So it's kind of sad to me, like, we'll get these early things, like everyone's going to cover Don't Worry Darling or all these films that, you know, Warner Bros and Disney or, you know, Netflix are all producing, like all going to be releasing. Like they're secure. What needs to be covered a lot more is the ones that aren't. But, you know, it's kind of difficult when for me as a freelancer, you know, what films do I ever get the opportunity to cover or review? You know, one of the great things with The New Arab as an outlet that I write for is that I get to cover a lot of Middle East and North African films, which I never get asked to review in any other, which I mentioned in the book. I haven't been asked to do a review. I think it was one time I was covering a column and I managed to do something at the Darden Brothers, Young Ahmed, but I didn't really like that film. And again, white filmmakers.
I hate the Dardens. I hate them.
So, but I like Rosetta.
I've not seen Rosetta, so I might be biased because of that.
That one was a great one. I really enjoyed that. Okay. And again, that's why I mentioned it in the when I talk about Mother. It's like, oh wow, this is quite. Again, you kind of see even things you see recently. You're like, that's how I wonder how I can relate that to my own, you know, my own life and my mom and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so it's interesting what the position you are as a film writer or critic, there's the stuff that you'd love to cover and what you're allowed to cover. And I suppose I could, you know, write for free, but again, this is my career. You know, if I, you know, I'm in a position where I don't really want to write for free.
Or wash your mouth out straight away, write for free.
Well, this is the thing. Like someone said to me, oh, do you do reviews on Letterboxd? And I'm like, do I get paid? Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong. I mean, I keep a little spreadsheet of all my films that I've watched. And actually, I've thought for the book, I've created a list of all the films that I reference, all the ones that are actually on Letterboxd. And that way people can maybe kind of look at, refer to that list and maybe tick things off. But yeah, it's difficult when you write for a living, writing for yourself. I mean, yeah, doing this book was intense. Yeah. And I did not get paid hardly anything compared to what I paid for my freelance work as a critic and, you know, journalist. Right.
I think that the worst one, the one I recently had to do, not necessarily the worst one, but I had to do a review for Sight and Sound for Kim Ki-duk's final film before he was before he died of COVID at the age of 59.
Yeah.
And the accusations against him are vile. I mean, he's behaved, I think, in a fairly rotten way. It's the weird thing that I have of sort of when you have someone who's sort of more than a controversial figure, a sort of someone with credible accusations against them, against him usually, then it's such a relief when the film isn't that good. So, it's like Woody Allen's really helped me out by not making a decent film for the last 10-15 years. But, you know, but I can't deny I love Woody Allen movies and have, you know, he was a formative influence, you know, on me. But I, you know, I just don't, I don't know if they can be sort of taken away in the sort of reverse version of The Rapture where we just sort of get rid of them because I don't know.
I don't know if it's getting rid of them. It's just like
looking at other people. But
that's what I mean. Like, I feel like, you know, people who study, again, you know, from what you hear and stuff, like most people's, when I hear about people's curriculums, I remember someone actually who was doing film at university, and she DM'd me and she goes, oh, you know, I'm having a bit of an issue because like I'm doing a course and every single person on that course is like a white man. And I feel like I want to say something. It's like, well, you should say something. Like, who decides what, you know, again, like no one's taken away. Luckily we live in a world where everything's, you know, we have the library, you know, we have everything's available. No one's erasing Woody Allen. No one's going back and saying Manhattan is not a fantastic movie or, you know, Annie Hall and all that. You know, I love Midnight in Paris. Like, that was an amazing movie. It makes me kind of like, and, you know, no one's taking that away from them. But maybe it's kind of within hindsight, we're saying, okay, but who else was around at that time? Who else can we also champion? I think it's having the context that comes with it. It's like, you know, when we look at, you know, because I see that argument the same way when people call out, when people are talking about the British history, and actually we're talking about, like, when people say, actually, can we acknowledge the fact that, you know, when that statue, that slave owner statue in Bristol got pushed into the river, or the fact that now these heritage sites, when it comes to their history, they're acknowledging where these things have come from, where the wealth come from. It came from, you know, slavers who earned money from whatever, I don't know, sugar farm plantations or whatever, all that. And that's how they built these towns up, you know. And it's and that's what I think it is. It's adding the context about like who they are at that time as well. So I feel like, I don't feel like it's about erasing. I think it's just, let's just not ignore the other stuff. I mean, I mentioned him a bit. I talk about the time when when Sean Connery died. And, you know, I love Sean Connery. Like, Sean Connery is like the dude, like, I love him in, you know, I love that First Night, you know, the Richard Gere.
Richard Gere, right.
Yeah, love that film. Like, The Rock. Like, you know, there are so many films apart from James Bond that I love. And when I kind of tweeted, like, you know, when he died, I was like, oh, you know, RIP, you know, I said a problematic fave who might have shared a little bit too much in common with the machismo or something like that about James Bond. But I thought I was very clear to say I love him, but he also might have been, because he's admitted to like slapping his wife and being quite a lot of misogyny. God, the attacks I got on that, like the trolling I got for saying that. And it was like, there are people actually calling him a wife beater, and like me being trying to take a very diplomatic approach to wanting to acknowledge someone, you know, acknowledge someone who I've adored, but also the fact that, yeah, they're problematic as well. Like, they've had a, you know, iffy history when it comes to how they've treated women off screen, you know, because I think there's this, especially with actors, you know, we see them on screen, we idolize them, we can't imagine that they could be doing terrible things behind the scene, but they're not the characters that they play, you know, they're just, that's the performance, right? These are the real people. And so I feel like a lot, you know, there's a lot of people think, you know, oh, you're just trying to erase it, or you're trying to change history. No, we're just trying to show the real history, not the whitewashed version of it that is palatable to people who kind of want to maintain this kind of nostalgic view, rather than just acknowledging that actually people aren't perfect, you know, they're people. And that's what I feel like for me, you know, I do think there is, you know, you can talk about like cancel culture and that, but I also think it's just consequence culture. And I feel like a lot of people who complain about, oh, we're trying to raise, you know, these people off the curriculum, all this type of stuff. It's like, no, maybe it's just like making more space to understand that, you know, again, like when you look at, you know, I think Helen O'Hara's book, Women in Hollywood, really just shows how much women have been, you know, have been erased from the conversation. And we need books like hers to show that, no, they are within the very like foundation of what old cinema used to be until men came in and, you know, kicked them out. And it's like, it's sad to me that I didn't know a lot of these filmmakers' names, these female filmmakers' names, because again, who are the people that we champion? Mm. Who are the ones who keep on hitting the 100 greatest films list, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we, you know, that's the problem we live in. That's the kind of struggle we have right now. So, but again, it's a really complicated, there's no black and white answer to it, really.
Yeah, no, I tell you the truth. I totally agree with everything you've said there. I mean, I don't, I have no
problem
with that.
Because that's the correct answer.
Oh, well, you know, I was expecting no less. I mean, I'm always ready to, I always assume I'm wrong, but I go because, you know, I go ahead because it's, you know, every mistake is an opportunity to learn.
Us having this conversation now, if we had this on social media, I'm sure it could descend into like us taking, you know, taking tone, like thinking, oh, wait, are we actually having, this seems like an argument. And it's not, it's like a discussion. So that's really good to have this dialogue with people rather than take it offline rather than, you know, trying to do it in 280 characters and then
absolutely
offended and blocking.
Well, I never block, I just mute.
I might soft block.
Yeah. Yes.
Get them. It's like, stop following me. That's what I also don't understand. It's like, don't follow me.
Yeah.
You are here. People who follow, what I think is so funny is like, people who will follow you, you don't follow them back. And they'll say something to you, and you're like, I don't even know who you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't owe you a conversation. I don't owe you anything. It's interesting where that, how that, the kind of like the etiquette has kind of somewhat been lost on social media. But, you know, this is why I really enjoy chatting about these things now, because I think it's really interesting to hear those opposing views. But when you realize it, most of us kind of all kind of agree. We just say it in different ways.
Well, we all want, it reminds me of what Shirley Jackson once wrote to a reader who complained about her short story, The Lottery. She said, if you don't like my peaches, why did you shake my tree?
That is so true. That's so true. And I think that's so interesting, but because that reminds me of like the kind of there's a conversation where it's like, who are reviews for?
Mm.
Like, because I don't know about you, but when you review a film, you know, I don't expect the filmmakers to read it, you know, unless it's amazing, and then I want them to see it, and then I want them to, like, you know, remember my name.
invite you for dinner at Christmas.
Yeah, you want me to host your award season Q&A? Sure. I'll fly to LA, thank you.
But who do you think they are for then, the reviews that we're writing, the stuff that we're doing?
For audience goers, for movie watchers.
Right.
I feel like that's, you know, because I feel, it's interesting because when I, as someone who's, I suppose it's different as a professional in the industry or people who write stuff, I'm very aware of not reading reviews before I've come to see the movie, because I don't want to have that influence my opinion, because this is what I do for a living and I don't want to just regurgitate what other people say. I think that can sometimes, I had someone the other day who DM'd me, was asking about, you know, how she was, I think she does like Letterboxd reviews, and she wants to know how to like become a writer.
Mm.
I gave her a bit of like tips. So maybe try these blogs, or I'll try a new writers. And then she said to me, she goes, oh, great. Well, you know what? I love your Twitter, and I always recycle your takes as my own. And I was like, oh. And I was like, that's kind of weird. And I said to her, maybe come up with your own takes though, because that's literally the point of being a critic.
Yeah. Why you know? Yeah.
It was an interesting that someone would admit that. So I'm glad I kind of said that to her. But yeah, that's the thing. I don't want to be influenced by, you know, obviously after it, there's some great, and I love reading reviews because it makes me better. I feel like it makes me a better writer to see people who I consider probably better at the job than I am, or have a different perspective.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
but I think, like, yeah, that's who I'm doing it for, like, you know, the every person, like anyone who wants to watch a movie and speak in their terms, who might want some guidance, you know.
It's, yeah.
But, you know, obviously, if I always think, like, you know, filmmakers, read your own reviews at your own, you know,
peril,
really. Wow. And that's what I have to do now, because I don't know, I've got this, I actually was talking to my therapist recently, is why I'm seeking out criticism. When I like search the things online about the books, like, because I'm like, because I want to know if anyone's saying shit about it. It's like this weird urge. yeah, I've got a few more therapy sessions to really get into that. but it's weird. Like, now I'm in a position of like, oh, people are going to review my work. How am I going to feel if someone says it's absolute garbage, or just hates it, you know? Mm.
And somebody will, because everything is somebody's favorite and somebody's worst of whatever, you know. Every single thing is has, you know. But they'll be idiots. The people who hate will be idiots. This leads us on to the last question, really, which is what is a film book that you would recommend to our listeners?
Well, women in Hollywood, I'd have to say Helen Hart. I'm sure you've had her on, right?
Yeah. She was on like last year when it came out, the book.
Yeah, I think for me, that was a really, I read that in one day. That I just steamed through it and just kind of like, oh, this is so, this is so accessible and easy to understand, and not, again, like not being overly academic, even though it's a history book, right? And I really love the sections that she covered. It gave me a load of new writers and films to kind of check out and, you know, and also acknowledge. And it made me smarter by reading it. But also, you know, I mentioned I really recommend, and maybe it's not like the, you know, it's not like the page share, but Jack G. Shaheen's Real Bad Arabs, spelled R-E-E-L, Bad Arabs. It's just if you've ever wanted to just see, like, he goes through like 1,000 films from, you know, the first film, silent films, to like, I think, because he unfortunately died, I think it was in 2015. So the version I have is like the third edition. So there's things like post 9/11, a bit post 9/11 films in there. But it was honestly such an amazing resource for me when I was writing the book. Because again, you know, seeing some of the things I was talking about, like we talk about the bombers, belly dancers and billionaires tropes, that kind of the three Vs that often Arabs get painted as. And he has got this an amazing like reference for the films, and he kind of talks about what were the good things about the film, what the bad things about the film, like and specific and some historical references. It was so amazing. Like, you know, it was until I read that book that I realized, like, Back to the Future. I didn't, like, maybe rewatch. I was like, wait, Back to the Future, what happened at the beginning? I was like, oh yes, the Libyan terrorists, which are just insane, and like they're speaking gibberish, and you know, they're wearing their keffiyehs and just looking absolutely bonkers, and you're like, oh, that's how it that's how easy these terror stereotypes just get embedded within popular culture. You know, something as you think is quite inoffensive as Back to the Future, it's right there in the beginning. You know, I love True Lies. I love that film. And then you realize that, wait a second, yeah, this is kind of bad. Like, this is a really shitty, really like anti-Arab, like terrorism. And, you know, as I say in the book, it's kind of all the rage. So having that book as a reference was amazing. And for anyone who is interested to see things that they might have missed, and even just having a book, you know, and also he lists down all the good ones as well. He's like, these are the good ones as well. So yeah, I thought that for me is a really great reference book for anyone who kind of wants to learn a bit more about what the obvious and not so obvious films that basically kind of continue to position Arabs as these evil megalomaniac, psychotic, you know, overtly sexual people. They're as much as that as white as the Western world is, you know. It's what's interesting about it when you realize a lot of these stereotypes, like, yeah. So there you go, Helen O'Hara's Women in Hollywood and Jack G. Shaheen's Real Bad Arabs.
Brilliant. That's excellent. That's really that's great. I love a dip. Well, I've already read Helen's, obviously, but I'll look up Real Bad Arabs because I haven't seen that yet. So that's
it's very thick. It's right. Like it will, you can hold open a door with it. Like, it's such a good reference. Like, anything's like, wait, what about Rules of Engagement? You go, oh shit.
Excellent. Well, listen, Hannah, it's been really brilliant reading the book and wonderful talking to you. I think we've had a detailed, nuanced, complex conversation, which is almost as good as Twitter, but not quite.
No, well, thank you so much. It's been so nice to be able to chat about it. And yeah, it's so nice to be able to, I don't know, speak with people who like my book. But no, thank you so much.
So that was my conversation with Hannah. We had some technical difficulties I didn't mention at the beginning so as not to distract you, but there were some technical difficulties with the connection, so that's why the conversation was a little bit interrupted. But I hope it didn't impede your enjoyment of the conversation, and it was a revelation. It was an interesting, fascinating discussion with Hannah, and I really hope that we'll have the opportunity to continue that conversation, as I'm sure she will continue to write great stuff, and maybe even a follow-up book. I hope so. All that's left really is for me to thank Elliot Atkins for the music and Ali Howard for the art, and thank you, dear listener, for joining me. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, please take care.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.